Welcome, everybody, to our committee hearing today. It's the House Committee on Higher Education. Today is February the 7th. We have three bills right off the bat that we can conduct work sessions on, and we have two bills coming up after that that are scheduled for public hearings and possible work sessions. So with that, I think I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 4056. You'll recall this is the bill that establishes a task force on STEM access and success. This was the bill we carried over from our previous meeting, and perhaps Victoria can refresh her memory about what this is about.
Sure, glad to. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4056 creates a task force on STEM access and success to research and report on strategies for encouraging students to study science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, establishes STEM fund for purpose of providing scholarships to science, technology, engineering, and mathematics students, sunsets upon convening of the 2013 legislative session, declares an emergency effective on passage, and last week we adopted -2 amendments, which allowed the task force to accept donations of staff support, office space, and equipment from businesses and advocacy organizations to assist in the performance of its functions. Also precludes legislative members of task force from receiving mileage reimbursement or per diem for work on the task force, and expanded the task force membership to 16, including 2 senators and 2 representatives. Has a minimal fiscal impact and does have a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means.
Okay, thank you, Victoria. And we have already voted on the dash twos, is that correct? All right. So I would entertain a motion on this bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4056 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So Co-Chair Dembro has moved that we move House Bill 4056 -2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation that be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any additional discussion? Was that a thumbs up or was that
nope.
A yes? Okay.
No. I was just holding a pencil and pressing my iPad.
Shouldn't use a pencil. He was demonstrating technology in action. That I think you were tied into the bill. I certainly love the bill. As we talked about at the last hearing, there's not a legitimate referral to Ways and Means here because there's no fiscal impact on the bill, but I understand that one of the co-speakers wants it to go there, so looks like that's the only option. I don't want to hold that up because it's an excellent bill. Thanks for working on it.
Any objection? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Harker?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Lindsay?
Aye.
Representative Sheehan?
Yes.
Co-Vice Chair Greenlee?
Yes.
Co-Vice Chair Springer?
Yes.
Co-Chair Dembro?
Aye.
Co-Chair Johnson?
Yes. Passes. We will do it right.
Yes, you're fine.
close the work session on House Bill 4056. We will now open a work session on House Bill 4058. Victoria, what can you tell us about that? This is the textbook bill.
House Bill 4058 directs Joint Boards of Education and Higher Education Coordinating Commission to convene a work group and prepare a report on strategies for reducing higher education textbook costs, declares an emergency effective on passage. And we have -2 amendments ready for discussion.
Okay. Co-Chair Dembro, would you be willing to discuss the -2 amendments that we have in front of us?
Sure. Mr. Chair, the -2s were efforts to bring down the fiscal on the bill. We talked about this last Thursday. There was concern that if the process was shepherded through the joint boards process, then that would be a significant fiscal to the CCWD and the state board and the OUS system. And so we are going to start the actual implementation of the bill with the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, which comes into existence on July 1. We don't think it'll have any substantive impact on the bill's effectiveness, but it will allow us to move this forward with no significant, well, really with no impact on those agencies. Mm-hmm. So To that end, I would move the dash two amendments to House Bill 4058.
Any discussion? Any amendments? Any objection? I would just add that I was able to have a conversation with the governor's people yesterday about the need for actually appointing the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission now that we're beginning to assign additional responsibilities to that phantom body, so it'd be nice to have something there that can actually proceed with the work that we're putting on their plate before they're in existence. So with that, would you give us a motion?
Yes. Chair Johnson, I move House Bill 4058 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Chair Dembrough's moved House Bill 4058 with the dash two amendments to the floor, due pass recommendation, and a subsequent referral to Committee on Ways and Means. Any further discussion?
Just if I could, Mr. Chair, you know, I am really looking forward to this process, and I'm looking forward to the hours and hours of support that we're going to get on this from the Oregon Student Association and from the Oregon Community College Association and AFT and anyone else who's in the room who's a strong believer in textbook affordability.
Well said.
I would just again say we have now, this is the second bill in a row that clearly has no fiscal impact, that is Ways and Means. I mean, we have a serious flaw in our process right now that we're sending bills that are clearly policy bills, avoiding the Senate Policy Committee in discussion, sending them down to Ways and Means, which unfortunately risks, I think, their future health. This is a critically important bill. I fully support it, so I'll be a yes on it. I just want to register ongoing concern that we've got a serious flaw in our process right now.
Thanks for that input. Would you please call the roll?
Can I?
Certainly.
I'd just like to say I support this bill. As you heard me say, I think the price of textbooks now is completely outrageous. I wish we could think of something stronger to do than name a task force. And maybe the task force will come up with some answers, but frankly, I think we need to find those answers in this body and help some of us can think about it for the next session and perhaps have some independent ideas to try and solve the problem. It's, I think it's a code red problem.
Thank you.
If I could respond to that, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I mean, I fully agree with that. But I will say that I believe that some of the work that the work group will be doing is going to lead to practices that don't need legislation, you know, where, you know, it will engender some partnerships that can be done by the institutions themselves without our having to tell them to do it. If they don't do it, then we'll have to tell them to do it. I'm not going to rule out that we can't move forward on this significantly within the next year.
Very good. We're ready.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Lindsey?
You're up.
I'm up to vote?
Yep.
Aye.
Thanks.
Representative Sheehan?
Yes.
Co-Vice Chair Greenlee?
Yes.
Co-Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Dembrough? Aye.
Co-Chair Johnson?
Aye.
So with that, House Bill 4058 is adopted. Okay. We'll now open a work session on House Bill 4061. And when we last were together, we had adopted the dash four amendments. Victoria, would you like to help us understand all of that?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4061 establishes the Task Force on Higher Education Governance and Coordination to review issues of governance within the higher education system and coordination among elements of that system with other education programs and missions, specifies task force membership, and requires report to the Legislative Assembly and Governor no later than November 1st, 2012, sunsets upon convening of 2013 legislative session, declares emergency effective on passage. Proposed amendments that were adopted last week include changing the name to the Special Committee on University Governance and specifying the duties of the committee. It has an indeterminate fiscal.
Thank you, Victoria. Is there any further discussion on this bill before we bring it to a vote?
Mr. Chair, I had given to the committee, and I'm not seeing that it's been distributed.
I have right there. I think we received it individually over the course of last day.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I guess I would ask that they be distributed out to members of the committee. We've got the dash. We've got all other amendments that we're considering on other bills, so I would ask that those be handed out to members, at least so they have the opportunity to see those amendments.
It was my understanding that there wasn't adequate support to actually consider them. I'd be more than happy to let you talk about them, but in the interest of...
I guess I'm not understanding how people know if there's adequate information to consider them. How would I talk about something people don't have in front of them?
We have had them in front of them in our office, I think. Mm-hmm. That's my...
Has anyone not seen the Dash 5 amendments?
I have.
You've seen them?
I have.
Okay.
I have.
Yeah.
I'd be happy to speak to them then. There, I mean, fundamentally, really following up on our conversation about the Dash 4 amendments, there are three changes. One, which really gets at the issue of is this a special committee that's going to be focused on exploring best practices and coming up with the best recommendations that make sure that we are coming up with the best possible recommendations, or are we prescribing something that may or may not be the best recommendation? So it only the Dash 5s would only change three words. They would change in line 14 of the Dash 4s, change shall recommend to may recommend. In line 15, change the plan to a plan. And then on page 2 in line 19, instead of defining a rapid timetable, just define a timetable. So I think you're right, Mr. Chair, in terms of there are not the votes to pass the Dash 5, so I will not move the Dash 5s. As a result, as I think I've told both the co-chairs, I will remain a no, principally, not because I don't think there's a possibility that local boards might not be a good thing, not because I don't think we shouldn't have a full comprehensive study of what the best practices are, but I think there's just an element where we're buying a pig and a poke here, where we're saying, go forth and study, but here's your conclusion. And I'm very concerned, especially about the impact on tuition. And I will confess, it's as a parent of a child who's a junior in high school, and tuition is right around the corner for our family. But that's true for a lot of my constituents too, and I think I've seen too many years of individual universities coming in and recommending and asking for one level of tuition increase, and the legislature has done, I think, actually a pretty good job of moderating those tuition increases. I just think that it's critically important that continue. This bill, as it's drafted, calls for individual boards without guaranteeing that tuition affordability.
Thank you, Representative Honey. Appreciate that. And as the parent of a college freshman, I share your concerns about the cost of tuition and costs in higher ed in general. Textbooks, I mean, you can go down the line, obviously. We can talk about a lot of costs. So, I guess I would just reassure you and others that I think this task force will have a tremendous amount to say about containing of costs as it does its work. I think that will be one of the clear criteria for the adoption of local boards is that I think that if this legislature gets to that point, that that'll be a key point to ensure that there's a plan for making sure that those things happen. But having said that, we also recognize that at this point in time, there's a lot of energy and there's a lot of enthusiasm about just as we see throughout our whole public education world in Oregon, there's a lot of inertia to move forward and into a better place, and I think that this bill will help to get us there. But I think it outlines a process that I think yes, it is purposeful, and it's ambitious, but I also think it's going to be open and transparent, and it's going to have a very heavy legislative fingerprints on it, whatever recommendations come back to this body for the 2013 session, and then we'll all have a chance to work on whatever those recommendations or that legislation is. So, Representative Dembrough, would you like to contribute anything or before we move into a vote?
Well, I'll say a couple of things. First of all, members, in your packet, you know, I put together a little cheat sheet on the, you know, the elements of the Dash 4 amendments, you know, just to help see what its elements are. And, you know, I just want to, you know, reiterate that, you know, as envisioned, the process that this special committee is going to embark on, and it's going to be a hard process, I mean, I can say, but that it will be, as the co-chair said, transparent, it'll be consultative, it'll be fact-driven, and it'll be driven also by a set of principles. You know, the first is, you know, to look at the potential benefits of local boards. In addition to that, ensure that the creation of a local board is the result of a careful analysis of the costs and the benefits of such action. If a local board is created, ensure that students, faculty, and other university staff will be represented on the board. Will mitigate potential adverse impacts on other public universities. And then finally, ensure that the public mission of Oregon's public universities, including access and affordability for residents of this state, is maintained and enhanced. If we can do all of that, I think we will have done a very good thing for this state. It's not going to be easy, but I think that the passage of this bill will put us on track to begin the hard work that this is going to entail. I just want to say I fully appreciate the intentions of the Dash 5 amendments, and I really appreciate Representative Hunt for putting them forth. What we have here, I think, in the Dash 4s is a clear path to passage, and I want to move on with it. And move to what I really firmly believe is going to be a good process and a process that will get us to a bill that can pass in 2013.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Greenlee, give a comment.
Yes, thank you. I do. I was committed to voting yes on this bill to help it get out of committee, and I will continue to vote yes on this committee, on this bill in committee. But I might not vote yes on this bill on the floor. I continue to think it's the wrong approach. Just as Representative Hunt pointed out, moving things to Ways and Means gets bills out of the purview of the Policy Committee. I think this directly moves things out of the purview of the Policy Committee, our committee, and the Senate Committee. And it's possible the co-chairs will be on the committee and therefore there'll be some representative. But I suppose it's also possible that they won't be. And it might be four members of the House who aren't on this committee who are on this. I mean, it's a toss-up. But the fact is, I wasn't crazy about the last joint committee mm-hmm. that did its work. I wasn't necessarily crazy about its outcome. And I think we have policy committees. I mean, what happened after the last committee was we ended up with a policy committee on higher ed, and now we're abandoning that committee to do the most important job to be done in the interim, and it's giving it to somebody else. And I frankly think there's a place for policy committees in this legislature, and this, I think, moves the most important issue that we could deal with out of the purview of this committee and the Senate Committee on Higher Ed. And I think, frankly, that's a bad idea. But I will be voting yes today.
Thank you, Representative. Any other comments?
Mr. Chair, I probably should have done this already. I move House Bill 4061, as amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Dembrough has moved House Bill 4061 with the dash fours amended to the floor. Do pass recommendation, subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any further discussion on that? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
No.
Representative Lindsey?
Aye.
Representative Sheehan?
Yes.
Co-Vice Chair Greenlee?
Yes.
Co-Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Co-Chair Dembrough?
Aye.
Co-Chair Johnson?
Aye.
And the bill passes. Close the work session on House Bill 4061. And we'll now move into a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 4057.
Moving into a possible work session.
As possible.
Hearing. Well, that's what's on the agenda for the work session.
Victoria, would you tell us what this one's about?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4057 requires the State Board of Education and State Board of Higher Education to establish baselines and conduct annual reviews of each public institution of higher education with respect to employee numbers in different employee groups and ratio of employees in groups to students enrolled. Declares an emergency, effective on passage. We have dash two amendments currently in front of you for discussion.
Okay. Thank you, Victoria. So, we do have some testimony lined up, but I guess what we'd like to talk about, first of all, just the intent behind this bill. I'll let Representative Dembrough weigh in on this, too, but I think what we're trying to get at, I think, here, try to understand more clearly, are some of the reasons that could potentially be the drivers behind the tuition increases. You know, as we've heard today from, in the next last few days, from so many students about their concern about the cost of their education, what could be done to maintain that, hold it, reduce it, whatever. Are there things we can be doing? So what this bill is going to do is to create a pathway to really begin to examine staffing ratios in our institutions of higher ed and to just see if there's any correlation in there between perhaps some institutions, what they're doing in regards to their ratio of faculty to classified, to administrative, and so forth. Are there any best practices, perhaps, that one institution could learn from another and so forth? But it's just going to be an awareness-raising opportunity. So, maybe Representative Dembrough, do you have any further comments to add to that?
So, you know, I've been working with the with OUS and with the community colleges to make sure that this could be done in a way that didn't put undue burdens on them. And so we have made some amendments. There's a dash two amendment. There was a dash one amendment, but a change was left out. And so that's why we have dash twos. They're pretty minor, actually, you know, important to the to OUS and the community colleges. And I'll just tell you quickly what they are. In the original bill, the State Board of Education is charged with collecting the information from the community colleges and then passing it on to the legislature. We've replaced State Board of Education with Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development because they're the people that really do it. There was concern from CCWD and the community colleges that the current reporting timeline, remember this is built off of an already existing practice that had been created under House Bill 2557 from the 2009 session that mandates an annual report from OUS and the community colleges on faculty, full-time versus part-time. This is being expanded now to include all employee groups. There was concern among the community colleges that that October 1st date was just not workable for them, and they begged to have it be later. And, you know, when the community colleges come begging, you just have to say yes. And so we have changed that to March 1st. Which they said would make this, you know, really mitigate the impact on them. OUS also begged for some leniency, and so we're giving them until December 1st. And the, you know, remember the challenges for for OUS are not as great as for the community colleges in that because they are a single system, one of the benefits of being a single system is there's greater commonality of reporting. And so they should be able to make that December 1st deadline without any trouble and keep us on track. We did change the in the original bill for the faculty piece, we talked about courses taught. We want to know the ratio of courses taught by full-timers as opposed to part-timers. You know, it was being applied not looking at specific courses being taught, but rather the percentage of students being taught by full-timers versus part-timers. And so we've made a change that just gives a little more flexibility there, and it calls for the ratio of instruction provided by full-timers as opposed to part-timers. That's really what we're interested in. We did add among the things to be looked at for the faculty, their wages are looked at. In the bill, in the original House Bill 4057, we didn't ask for the average wages for the different employee groups. We are now asking for that. That seems like useful information for us. So those are the elements of the dash twos, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about them.
We have one individual signed up to provide some input for us today. He's probably the tallest guy in the room. I'll let Mr. Wyckoff come forward here and share with us.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
One question of Chair Deck.
Certainly.
Thank you. When we're asking them to report on average compensation, are we including in that all compensation or just salaries, as you stated?
We already were asking them for benefits and other benefits. I forget what it said exactly. And now it just adds wages to that. Okay. So we are looking at total compensation.
Full package.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Community College Association. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 4057. Community colleges understand the need for transparency in our operations, and we've made a good faith effort to provide accurate and verifiable data as currently required in existing reporting requirements for full-time and part-time employees. And I should say, you know, we appreciate Representative Dembro and the committee working with us that the legislative body is going to take this approach. The flexibility that's been added into the Dash 2s alleviates some of the concerns that the colleges have had about trying to provide good data that's actually representative of what's going on in the campuses and gives data that's actually useful. I'll talk a bit more about that. In the current reporting requirements, there have been difficulties about first with extremely thinly staffed institutional research departments, human resources and academic affairs functions, in just trying to pull all of this data. For example, at one of the smaller colleges, a business affairs person had to actually pull each individual employee record to look at payroll information. And we don't think that was probably the intent of how that was supposed to work. So there's been a bit of a process just with the current reporting of trying to deal with the fact that not all colleges are defining things like full-time, part-time employee the same way, that there are differences, and to try to find a way that's going to provide a sort of apples-to-apples comparison. But it's also been somewhat of a difficulty just based on the thin staffing and at the level we're talking about. I'll just give you a few examples. At one of our medium-sized colleges, this was a college that in the 90s would have had about 50 management or director-level positions with a student population of about 22,000. Now, those 50 managers and directors include, they aren't just academic side. We're talking the manager, the custodial manager, the maintenance manager. So that number of 50 for 22,000 students in the 90s is now, at this medium-sized college, 31 of those sorts of managers and directors for now 38,000 students. So this is an area where we're already very thin, for example. And so that's been part of, I think, the difficulty. Let me just give you one more example. At the same college, you're looking at a situation where one dean would have about 60 full-time faculty and 300 part-time faculty under them for one dean, which is a very difficult load to carry. And so that's been part of the difficulty, is just how thinly staffed they are to begin with. But at the end of the day, if we aren't able to create data that's a bit more uniform, it's not going to be it's not going to be of much value to the legislature. And I think the amendments try to address that, allowing the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development to define what we're looking at and what we're measuring and what these, you know, or what the different categories are, and then give you sort of a percentage of each category. I think that alleviates some of the concerns that are had here and in our ability to provide good workable information. And then again, as Representative Dembro referenced, the timeline just would not have worked because the colleges wouldn't have had the data that they would need at that time, and it's a very difficult time for them. So that's helpful as well. So again, I think for the college's perspective, should this be the approach that the legislature takes, we do appreciate the Dash 2 amendments as a way to make providing this information a bit easier and to make the information hopefully useful for the legislative body. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thanks, John. Questions for Mr. Wyckoff? I'll do Mr. Edwin first. John, I get what you're saying about some of the difficulty in tracking data and stuff in terms of what the current, perhaps, state of affairs is. Does that mean that there may not be hardly any chance to track historical trends or patterns if we look back, you know, retroactively to, say, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, to see how they were? That doesn't sound like that's even in the realm of possibility, right? To look at historical trends and hiring patterns and staffing and then even further into compensation and stuff as well?
Chair Johnson, you know, it is going to depend. It's going to vary by each college. You know, for example, the president I talked to today was giving me data back to the 90s, showing how much their management and director level staffing has shrunk since the 90s as their student population has grown. Sure. And so, I mean, I guess the short answer is I suspect some of the larger and medium colleges would have an easier time providing some of that data, and that for some of the smallest colleges, those kind of projects can be larger or can be more difficult. Again, I mean, we had a smaller college that actually had to pull a lot of this data by hand with the original way we were doing it. I think they found a different way to look at the information that probably alleviates that.
And just one more follow-up then. Within the community colleges and the different employee groups, how many labor representation groups are represented within that too? Does it vary by school, or would it be accurate to say that each college has some of each different?
It varies by campus. I mean, we have one campus that has a non-affiliated unionized faculty. We have, you know, different. Some of our faculty, for example, are represented by the Oregon Education Association. On other campuses, it's the American Federation of Teachers.
Right.
So it does vary.
Okay, quite varying. All right, thanks. Representative Dembro.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. You know, one of the commitments that I've made to the community colleges and the universities is that, you know, after the bill passes, we will sit down and, you know, look at the categories and try to come up with something that really can work. So that, yes, it's going to be a challenge to look back and be able to compare apples and apples. I mean, I think it's worthwhile looking back in any case as a research project, but the whole point of this bill is to try to establish a baseline where we can henceforth compare apples and apples and, you know, really use that as a way to, you know, to have transparent conversations as opposed to just anecdotal, you know, people complaining about things without having the data to back them up. Or, you know, in other cases, those concerns will be justified, but we'll be able to look at it and then deal with it. So look forward to that process and working with you on it.
Chair Johnson, if I may, two things. And the first is we Because I would first say, as you know well, because we've come and talked to you about it, we have heartburn about this approach, and we appreciate you trying to help us alleviate that heartburn. So I think, you know, I think that makes it somewhat easier. But I think as far as the base, I mean, one of the issues that I've had come back from campuses is in situations where you have cut so deeply that you may not even have an appropriate staffing level, is you wouldn't want to see that somehow set in stone as
a baseline,
as an appropriate baseline, if in fact it isn't. And so I guess we would want to make sure that we can take kind of a qualitative look as well at whether these are appropriate staffing levels, because I think a lot of deans would probably argue that for one dean having 60 full-time faculty and 300 part-time faculty under them is not long-term workable. But that is the situation that many of the colleges are currently in. It is not, you know, it's not optimal.
Mm-hmm. And just follow up, and, you know, if possible, you know, the more appropriately we can slice the data, the better. That is, you know, if we can look at management, for example, in the instructional area as opposed to the student services area, as opposed to the just general college support area, you know, I think that would be useful. That would give us more of a snapshot of the real world. So that's something also I hope that we can talk about.
Chair Johnson, Representative Dembro, I think that's very important, and I think that's some of the feedback we got back from our campus is that want to make sure that we're looking at a difference between somebody who is a custodial supervisor as opposed to some of the on the academic side, or for example, where you have a federally funded grant that really mandates that you have a director who does compliance and directs the program, and that person is fully funded by the grant and requires you to have a director level person there that may or may not have staff under them. Sure. So we would want to make sure that that we're able to look at those sorts of things too, so that it's not all sort of put into the same bag and treated the same.
Perfect. Representative Greenlee.
Yes, I suffer under the fact that I've been a researcher in a vague field like health services research, and I know how easy it is to gather data, and then you have to figure out what to do with it. The only data I've ever found that's been really useful is data that answers a question. And a very specific question that, in fact, can be answered by the data that's being gathered. I ask you from the perspective of the universities or the schools, you have a sense that there are some questions to which this data might actually be usefully put to help you do what you all do in your daily life at running schools and universities? Or do we have to figure out some questions of our own to which we're going to put this wonderful data?
Well, Chair Johnson, Representative Greenlee, I think my impression is this is somewhat in the eye of the beholder, that different folks are looking for different data to look at. I don't want to suppose what legislators who are all looking at this are looking for out of it. I think what we're hearing from folks is that this is intended to be a tool to use. But I think where campuses will get heartburn is looking at, is it being used? Is this information being gathered to be a tool? Is it being gathered to be a hammer? And so I think it really depends. I mean, it's sort of in the eye of the beholder.
Can I follow on?
Certainly.
Well, I mean, that is only useful if it has if they have questions to which they provide answers. So my question is, well, I think it makes sense to be paranoid about what this is about. There's also the possibility that if people running specific institutions have some questions about, are we doing it right? And what makes right? What ought to be the right mix of these things? I mean, you would hope that that you all could use it in a way that would be useful. And I mean, theoretically, we have some questions.
Mm-hmm. Chair Johnson, Representative Greenlee, I mean, I think the first thing is, you know, those are the kind of questions that our locally elected boards are asking all the time. Are these appropriate levels? Do we have the right number? Do we have too many here? And I think our boards feel very, you know, very strongly that the locally elected boards still be able to be able to make those decisions. I mean, I think that this still provides that. But again, I think for the colleges, it's not the concern so much what the data will show or how it will be used. It's can we provide it in a way that's useful and is going to provide an apples-to-apples comparison. And for us, I think that's really the main issue, mm-hmm. is making sure that this is, we want to make sure it's not set up in a way that sets the colleges up to fail because they can't actually provide good information that's comparable. And so what I think these amendments try to do is create some flexibility so that the information is useful. And ultimately, I think that's the concern. Because I think when you look at what some of the staffing levels are right now, the concern isn't so much that they're going to look inordinately high. The concern would be that it's set as an artificial baseline where you may have, again, you may have inappropriately low levels of staffing.
Representative Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In what format are we asking for these reports? We're talking about how we might use the data, how they might be used locally, how we might aggregate them. Do we expect to get PDFs? I would argue that it would be nice to have the data in some sort of tabular format so that we can actually work with them, or that the campuses could compare their data in that manner.
Funnel all that through the organization, we can receive that back in some sort of cohesive form that makes it easier for us to make an apples-to-apples comparison.
Yeah, if I could just respond to that. You know, we do, we have so far gotten two reports as a result of House Bill 2557 having to do with the, you know, the faculty, and those come to us, I think, in the fall. And we can resend them to you just to see what it looks like currently. I think they did come in PDF form. You know, looking at institution by institution with some cover letter commentary. And it came in the form of two separate reports, one from OUS and one from community colleges. So, yeah. I think Sherry.
Further comments?
Did you have a question, Sherry? No. Okay. I would like to just say one thing. You know, there's a lot of talk in this building of these days about tight and loose, right? The notion that we want to be, as a legislature, we want to be tight on the outcomes and loose on the institutions as to how they meet those goals, those outcomes. And I think that and I'm a believer in that, and I know that the community colleges are a believer in that philosophy. In fact, I hear from them every day about that. The only way I believe that tight loose can work is if everything is done under the brightest of spotlights, right? Where there's transparency of information, so that you know we can see just how the outcomes are are being achieved, and what the institutions are doing to achieve them. It's not up to us to tell the institutions, what their ratios should be. But their ratios should be available and shared, able to be observed by all. So that's the goal with this legislation.
Well, I think it's just another tool. It's a tool that we can use as legislators to examine trends, patterns, all of the above, as we try to be the most efficient that we can as a system. So not to point fingers, but just to let light shine in that could be helpful for the whole system at large. So thank you for your testimony. Appreciate that. So we could move on the amendments if that would be...
Mr. Chair, I... details.
We're in a hearing. With that, we'll close the public hearing. We'll open up a work session on House Bill 4057. And we do have -2 amendments that are on the table, I believe, in front of us.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -2 amendments to House Bill 4057, dated today?
Yes.
February 7th, 2012. probably 2:30 p.m.
Thank you. So Rep. Dembrough has moved the -2 amendments for House Bill 4057, dated 2/7/12. Any further discussion on those? Any other comments or questions? Or
on the amendments or on the bill entirely?
Pardon?
On the amendments or on
the bill? On the amendments.
On the amendments.
Okay.
With that, we can say the amendments. Any objection to the adopt the amendments? So moved. We do have, you want to tell us about the fiscal that came back on this bill? We could actually move this today.
It's minimal. The fiscal is minimal.
There is no subsequent referral to Ways and Means with this bill. Is
correct.
That correct?
That is correct.
So it could go straight to the floor.
Yes.
Wow. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4057 be moved to the floor, as amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Representative Dembrough has moved House Bill 4057, as amended with the -2s, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion about that? Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, I hope somebody has some questions. And if we do have some specific questions, then I hope we're making sure the data will provide the answers to those questions. Otherwise, we're going to get another report, which before I stopped saving paper things, I had shelves full of them. Now they tend to come electronically so I can delete them quickly and not have to worry about storing them anywhere. This will be one more of those reports. Data, again, data is useful only if it answers questions. So while we're waiting for this data, especially since this committee probably won't have anything to do in the interim, maybe we could use the...
I would not say that.
We could use the interim time period to try and formulate some questions that the data could go to, because it seems to me if we're asking people to take an effort to get us some data, we ought to be prepared to use it in a real way. And I will support this bill. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, can I just say, we had scheduled 2 weeks ago, I think, an informational session on the cost drivers in higher education, and we were unable to get to it. So that has been rescheduled for... We'll deal with that next week or the week after, and I expect that is going to generate some questions on our part.
And do we hope that these will be the data that will help answer them?
In part, maybe.
Representative Springer. Oh.
Okay, actually, Sheehan.
Sheehan, he's spinning quite well.
Oh, he's in the queue.
Representative Sheehan. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to ditto Representative Greenlee's comments completely. I think we've got a lot of questions here that don't have really the thesis statement behind it is that there's some way for them to save money if we only knew the answers to these questions. And I see that this is the only thing that's guaranteed from this is that it's going to take staff time for them to respond to, which will drive up the costs of education when they're not doing their other job, which is educating kids. So, this is something similar to the opinions that I have about just about any K-12 education mm-hmm. requirement that we've put on them. I think they probably have a lot of internal processes and things that reports to their own boards where they're asking for different kinds of data. I suppose if we had specific questions, I might be more comfortable with it. But as it stands, I see this is kind of an unfunded mandate on education, which I don't really like. So I'm going to be a no on this, but I respect the committee's putting it forward.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess now I'll be echoing a couple of the comments. I think a lot of times we seek information to have a better understanding, and I think that's a great thing to do. I have to completely agree with Representative Greenlee that I would hope that we have some questions we want to ask or have answered, or we have a particular direction that we want to go other than we want some information, and then we'll see what the information tells us if we want to do something with it. And so for that reason, I am going to be a no. I don't think this is the worst thing in the world by any means, but I put this in the context of this committee passing out several task force bills and adding to workloads, which I have no problem with people having a full schedule. I have a full schedule. However, when we put some certain mandates on folks, and then we are certainly having a funding crisis because we have a job crisis and a revenue crisis, that, and then we're doing some significant overhaul to education, and I'm just wondering if the timing is right and if the data that we collect now is going to indeed be useful data with maybe at a slightly different paradigm that could occur. So for that reason, I'm going to be a no on this. Don't know what I'll do on the floor, but I would just caution us to carefully move forward as we add task forces to the pile. Even if they're minimal, they do add up, and somebody does the work, and something gets paid for by somebody.
Thank you, Representative. With some of the recent input we're getting here, I guess I'm wondering if perhaps it would be better just to carry this over to our Thursday meeting. We could have any additional discussions in the interim and make sure that we are, in fact, proceeding in a helpful and constructive pathway that is needful and useful and so forth. Again, as we talk about cost, I mean, there are some big topics out there that we need to be delving into. And as we talk about tuition, we talk about the cost of education, we hope to have a very substantive discussion about what some of these cost drivers are within the higher ed world. And I think the information gleaned from this could be helpful in that discussion. But having said, you know, heard some of the comments that we have here, I appreciate all your input. I think it's well thought out, and we're not in a giant hurry to make a bad decision, so I'm perfectly happy to hold this over till at least Thursday, and we can do that.
Okay.
So with that, we'll just go ahead and carry that over. House Bill 4057. Okay, with that, we're going to take a brief recess. We've got a witness that's going to be speaking to us on the next bill, so take five. us back into session here. So with that, we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 4059. Victoria, could you shed some light on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4059 directs Higher Education Coordinating Commission to implement strategies to increase awarding for credit for prior learning to Oregon students, to appoint an advisory committee to assist in these efforts, and to report progress annually to the Legislative Assembly. Also directs the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to report no later than November 1st, 2012, on a proposed partnership with Western Governors University.
Okay, another one of these topics that we are covering as we try to incentivize and make as many opportunities for our constituents and residents of the state to make as much progress as quickly as possible through either a degree or to some sort of certification within our higher ed system. So we talk about the concept of having credit or receiving credit for prior learning. That is a great concept, perhaps, and we'll learn more about that. So Representative Denbrough, would you have any more to share about that particular part of the bill?
Yeah, sure, Mr. Chair. And let me just say, just as background, we had a hearing on the issues in this bill back in November, I think, an informational hearing. The questions that we were posing at that time was, you know, how do we make it easier for non-traditional students to have access to higher education in this state, you know, to meet those 40-40-20 goals? We're not going to get to 40-40-20 simply by focusing on the kids who are currently in kindergarten or in the regular school system. We also have to be looking at non-traditional students, adult students, many of whom are already in the workforce, but who have a desire and a need to access higher education. There are a number of people who have, we believe, achieved competencies, proficiencies in subject areas due to training programs they've been involved in the military or through their work or, you know, through other means, that if we could have a system for awarding credit for what they have already learned, this is credit not for experience, but credit for prior learning, that could be assessed in an impartial, objective, and accredited manner, that would be a good thing for the students of Oregon, for the citizens of Oregon. So that got us looking at exploring ways to encourage institutions to do more of that. And at the same time, to look into a partnership with Western Governors University, which we had a presentation on last session, and Scott Jenkins from Western Governors is here to refresh our memories and answer any questions that we have. Looking at a partnership with Western Governors would again create a further set of options for students of Oregon that would be affordable, that would be regionally accredited, and that would really help them to succeed.
Okay. And you all, I think, remember, committee members refer to that hearing that we had, was that January or
November? No, it was November.
November, okay, regarding Western Governors University. We heard a very good hearing from them. But again, the as we go down that road towards trying to accomplish the aspirational goal, at least of 40-40-20, it's obvious that we're going to have to look for non-traditional means to help that to happen. We simply don't have the bricks and mortar available in this state to be able to put those numbers of students in classrooms, and the more opportunities that we can have available for, as Representative Denbrough said, I think non-traditional students or students who just want to choose a little different path to get to that degree certification or to that associates or whatever degree they're in pursuit of, we need to, I think, make those opportunities available. So this bill has a couple different components. One's the prior learning credit, the other would be the making progress towards relationship with Western Governors University. So We do have some people signed up to testify, and we'll find out what they have to share with us. Cam Price and John Wyckoff, representing the community colleges. Did you want to testify together?
Why don't we start with Scott? Just to
Scott? Okay. You want to go to Scott Jenkins, then? I think he can talk to us about Western Governors, and then we can shift into the community colleges, perhaps, about prior learning.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson, Chairman Denbro. My name is Scott Jenkins, and I'm the Director of External Relations for Western Governors University. Just to refresh your memory, Western Governors University is a university that was founded back in 1997 by governors, including Oregon Governor Kitzhaber, to provide a technology-driven post-secondary solution for states. We've really been in full operation for about the last 6 years, and Oregon's a full member of that. We have about 500 students in Oregon now, 250 graduates. I brought with me today Joanne Park, who is a faculty member, lives in Portland, faculty member with Western Governors University in our Teachers College. We're really here to be a resource, to answer any questions you might have. We're in strong support of the legislation because we think it's a good conversation for Oregon to have. We look forward to working with you throughout the process. On the prior learning side, we can use a little bit of our expertise because we have a way of working with the former EMT who's a soldier in Afghanistan and taking that experience and assessing that experience and credentialing that experience through assessment and in working in our university. So we do a little bit of that already, and we can share that knowledge with the process as we move through. Once again, we've kind of gone through a long discussion about what WGU is. You all are hopefully familiar with it. I've provided a copy of our 2011 annual report, and then within it, I put a three-page fact sheet. There were some questions raised last month at the Oregon Education Investment Board meeting, and we wanted to answer some of those concerns as clearly as we could, so that you all knew, you heard it from us, what the response would be, and get some accuracy there. But I'd be glad to answer any questions, and then Joanne is also here to talk about if you want to understand kind of what a faculty role is at the institution. We'd be glad to talk about that too.
Okay. Thank you, Scott. Joanne, why don't you go ahead and share with us, and then we can ask both of you questions after you've had a chance.
Okay. Thanks for having me. As a faculty member, I currently serve as a student mentor.
Please identify yourself.
Oh, my name is Joanne Park.
Perfect.
And I'm currently a faculty member at Western Governors University as a student mentor. We have several types of mentors. Student mentor, the role that I currently serve is a guide and I would say many ways an accountability coach. I would say advisor, consultant to students, and generally we have about an 80 plus, it's 80 to 90 student caseload where we follow these students from the start to finish, from when they begin with whether they have some transfer credits or not to graduation. I currently work in the Teachers College, so I advise students on their path towards student teaching and eventually credentialing in the state they serve.
Could you talk about that relationship in terms of frequency of contact and so
Sure.
forth? What's usual and typical for you?
Typically, on my end, I try to talk to a student once a week. Students are required to speak to us at least once every 2 weeks. I try to do once a week. And during this interaction, it would vary between 15 to 30 minutes. I will check in with them, discuss the progress in school, any challenges that they've encountered, set goals for the coming week. We'll review a graduation plan that I had set out that works with their goals, and we generally require about 20 hours minimum of student of schoolwork commitment. During that 15-30 minute session, I will have them either discuss with me what their plans are. If they're encountering any challenges, then I would connect them with what we call course mentors, who are subject area experts, or any other faculty or resources that will help them to obtain those proficiencies, or what we call competencies, so that they can successfully pass their assessments, whether they're objective exams or what we call performance assessments, where they will perform or apply some of their knowledge through papers, presentations, etc.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question, Joanne? How did you get into this?
That's a great question. I'm a high school English teacher by trade, but I've worked in all different school institutions, varying from the traditional public high school setting to I've worked in a community college as an adjunct faculty member and fellow at the UC Irvine Writing Project. I've worked closely with a lot of teacher education courses, and I. On a personal level, my mother went to school at a community college. I'm a daughter of immigrants, and she went back to school. It took her 9 years to finally get her BA, and she is currently a preschool teacher. And along the way, I helped her, basically mentored her through the process. And I realized in my own personal experience, my freshman year in college, I had a difficult time trying to manage my time. And I realized that as I had mentors along the way in a traditional university, I went to UC San Diego to get my undergraduate degree in the teacher program and English literature program. The more contact I had with faculty members and mentors, the better I performed. And then as I went through the credentialing program at UC Irvine, again, the closer I was with faculty members, the better I performed. And I realized that as a teacher, that helped, and when I applied that strategy in the classroom. But I wanted to check out the teacher education program in this sector, and I think we're doing some pretty amazing things for future students.
Excellent. Any other comments? Mr. Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a very useful handout. I'm fascinated by the map on the back, especially for Western Governors Association. I mean, the spread across the country is pretty amazing. And most of the student population numbers look like they roughly follow population of the state proportionally. But a couple of states jump out. I'm just wondering, for states like Georgia and Utah, are two that seem to have a disproportionately high number of students, are they doing anything differently? Are you all doing anything differently? How do you reconcile the disproportionately, what look like disproportionately high numbers there?
Representative Hunt, that's a really interesting question. The Utah is high because it's where the corporate headquarters is. Okay. So that's it's a Utah institution. It's been there for years. The Georgia phenomenon, when we've looked at the student enrollment patterns and things like that, we think a lot of it might be related to the size of the state is growing really rapidly, but also the influx of veterans and military within the state that can reach out, that are based there, and that can be served by the institution. It's so large, in fact, that next week we're having our graduation, our East Coast graduation in Atlanta. Where, I don't know, 1,000 students will graduate from the institution. Those numbers, too, are 6 months old now at this point, and the student enrollment has grown. I was commenting today to the Oregon Education Investment Board that 6 years ago we had 500 students that graduated total in the institution, and now we have 500 a month that graduate from the institution. And our role is just, you know, we were formed by Western Governors. We still have an active governor from both parties sitting on our board, and we are every day committed to serving states for this population, to be that kind of final low-cost safety net for adult learners who have not been, who just haven't been served and probably won't be served by the traditional sector. So thank you for asking the question.
Representative Lindsey.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And again, they're also a test case in the book, The Innovative University.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, they study them very, very well in that book. Mm-hmm. And talking about innovative things, one thing I did at my university was speaking Spanish. Having lived in Spain for a couple of years, they come back and they give you a test. And I got 16 credits for that Spanish language, having passed that test. And one more way to help people get through more quickly. other universities should use that probably or consider it.
Maybe we should just introduce this.
Yeah, I just have to follow up your question. If you talk about cost drivers, obviously one of the attractions for WGU is the relatively low cost, I guess. You say you're about $6,000 per 12-month period still, but it's only increased, you say, here about $200 in the past 6 years, so that's good stability, I guess I would say. But for you, what are the cost drivers that determine what that number is? What factors that you might experience as opposed to perhaps that allow you to maintain that versus another typical bricks and mortar type of a situation?
Mr. Chairman, that's a really good question. We, the vast majority of our resources are, and forgive me for being an old K-12 person, but are poured back into the classroom. Mm-hmm. All of our faculty are full-time. The cost drivers are less around student growth, but more about the fact that we don't have a print shop. We don't have to do facilities maintenance. So there are a lot of factors around what would be a traditional brick-and-mortar institution. Also, most of our faculty tend to it's a teaching institution, mm-hmm. so they're focused on teaching. And in fact, it's very the so by being online, every student has a voice over IP connection back to their mentor. We don't have a lot of the cost drivers that a traditional brick and mortar institution would have. But in all honesty, we also don't spend a lot of money for advertising. Mm. So we it's a lot of word of mouth. We rest on our graduates' reputations and what their positive feelings are and how we grow enrollment. But we've managed to stabilize, for lack of a better word, the business model by breaking down what faculty members do. And in a traditional institution, if you're going to offer an online course, an individual faculty member will have the role of everything. I mean, they have to decide what the student's going to know and be able to do at the end of the course, find the learning resources, teach the learning resources, assess the students, grade the students, all throughout that whole spectrum. At our institution, that's three or four different faculty members. And by doing that, you can have a faculty member like Joanne, who works with 90 students, and what her role is to make sure that student's matriculating through the process as quickly as possible. But she doesn't have to worry about building the tests or grading the tests or building the finding the course content or finding the learning resources. That's done by another faculty member. So by the other thing is, when you're in a course of study, there's pretty tight guardrails around that. You can't wander through the curriculum like you could at a traditional institution. Mm-hmm. So in a traditional institution, you might have an array of courses that you would take that would get you to your ultimate goal. At our institution, it's a step-by-step process through the system. For a 38-year-old or a 40-year-old single mother, you know, raising four kids, they don't need a lot of choice. They need a degree. They need to be able to go into the workforce and things like that. And it's been successful for that group, that population. Mm-hmm. And that's why our cost drivers are a little bit less. But we're not all things to all people, and we recognize that from the start. But for this student population, this is the model that works for them.
You mentioned that in your communication with the OEIB that there were some concerns raised or questions, and I'm assuming that this three-pager that you handed out addresses some of those. Could you just touch on those in general, just some of the concerns that might have been addressed, and then as we read through this, we can look for the answers?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think some of the questions around WGU are, what is this mm-hmm. thing? I think the core questions are, is who are the faculty? What are their credentials? What is the quality of the institution? I mean, all good questions that need to be answered, and we are very transparent in how we answer those questions. And that's why we, over the last 6 to 8 years, have every time we have a program, we seek program-specific accreditation, and we work through the traditional processes around quality. But I think those questions come up around that. And the other question, excuse me, that comes up is, and we don't shy away from it. We're addressing it, but we don't shy away from it. Of what is our graduation rate? And honestly, when you look at our IPEDS-based graduation rate, which is a 2-year-old rate reaching back six years, our rate comes up at 18% or somewhere around 20%. Well, unfortunately, our first time the student cohort that's part of that group is about is less than 20% of our student population. 80% of our student population doesn't get assessed because of iPads as a first-time in college student. Mm. When we look at our graduation rate, it's around 38%. Once again, it's a six-year rate from 2 years ago. So our institution, like I said, we graduated 500 students 6 years ago, and now we graduate 500 students a month. Over time, that rate's going to change. We look at also we look at what are our seven month retention rate. So those students who are going from one semester to another, which is in the 80 percentile range, and what is the 13 month retention rate, which is also in the 80 percentile range. Mm-hmm. So over time, we know that that rate's going to come up. But when you look at it from a blunt measure of graduation mm-hmm. rates, that's what you're going to have.
Okay.
But we have a very young. We're also dealing with a very young institution. Dealing with a population that by and large has not been able to be successful in the institutions that they've been enrolled in before. And those were the questions that were raised.
Okay, thank you very much.
May I just follow up on that, Mr. Chair? Thanks. Scott, Western Governors has accreditation through the Northwest Regional Accrediting Agency. How recently did you have that accreditation renewed? Do you know?
I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, what the answer to that is. I can get you that answer.
Yeah.
It's a current accreditation, though.
Mm-hmm. And did they have any concerns that, you know, they asked you to address that you know of?
If they did, I wouldn't know about them. But I do know that their acceptance of WGU Indiana was completely accepted. The WGU Texas was accepted. Those were seen as minor changes. So there's an underlying faith in the quality of our program and the quality of our faculty from Northwest. But I can get with my folks and get back with you on that.
Yeah, it would be useful if you could just send me the accreditation report. That would be useful. Thanks.
Representative Greenlick, do you have a comment?
I'd like to ask you a question.
Sure.
I assume you work normal hours. I wonder how you handle 90 students trying to spend a little time with each of them in a single week, including phone calls.
That's a very good question. One of our requirements is that as mentors, we hold at least 10 non-traditional working hours. The flexibility of my job is that I do work remotely. I work in Portland, and 75% of my interaction with students involve phone calls, and the rest involve emails or whatnot. I work as early as 7 o'clock. Sometimes I work into 8 o'clock, but I can take breaks when I schedule them into my calendar. And by and large, I do speak to about, I would say, 75 out of the 85 students weekly. 15, 20 minutes. Some calls will take 5 minutes. Others will take 25, depending on the need of the student. If that answers your question, Chairman.
Sounds like a big load. Mm-hmm.
Actually, 90 is not that bad. That's true.
As a high school teacher, I had more than that, and I had to grade and create curriculum.
Right. Do playground.
I hear the physicians in the health committee whining about 25 a day.
So do you have someone on the line, and who is that, Victoria?
Gervaise Dupree. Are you there, Gervaise?
I'm here. Can you hear me? I'm on a cell phone.
We hear you loud and clear. This is Representative Johnson. You're in front of the House Higher Ed Committee, so go ahead and share with us anything you'd like to about Western Governors University.
Well, I'm a student there. I'm in the last class of my master's degree in teaching in technology and learning. So I've had a wonderful experience. I did not know about or had not experienced online learning until I signed up with Western Gov. I knew about Western Gov and its reputation because when I lived in Colorado 15 years ago, Governor Romare and Governor Kitzhaber joined together with the other governors to start it. And then I was associated with the National Association of State and Land-Grant Universities in Washington, and they were the first ones to kind of support Western Gov as a sort of embryonic beginning of online learning. So I mostly just wanted to say that I have learned more from online learning at Western Gov than I ever learned in an on-campus classroom. And the reason is, first of all, Western Gov is been around, and they're very well structured and organized, and they have the best of staff, and that makes a big difference. Not all online schools you can say that about, but it's differentiated in the sense that it's much more one-on-one. As Joanne said, you have your own mentor for your program, and then you have an individual mentor, usually a PhD, in whatever course you're taking. So you have a lot of interaction. You also have interaction with other students through the bulletin boards, and it's more performance-based than it is test-based, even though there are objective tests in some of the courses. Much of it is performance-based. So what that means is it's just not what you know. It also demonstrates what you can do. And that's very unique, I think, to online learning if it's a really good environment. So I really have nothing negative to say about it. You know, I have a master's degree from Lewis and Clark College in public administration, and this degree has been so available because I could do it at my own time, my own pace. If I wanted to study in the middle of the night, I could, or early in the morning, I could. I do have a full-time job. It's very flexible, and it's very interactive, and I can't say enough good things about it.
Well, thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Dupree?
I do have a question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dembrough.
Gervais, hello. Welcome. This is Michael Dembrough.
Thank you.
Yes. Gervais, could you say something about the work that you do now? I mean, you're not a stranger to education, are you?
No, I'm not. I'm a policy analyst, senior policy analyst, and I've been involved in education all my life, but I've never been a teacher. And so when my little grandson started using mobile devices about 3 years ago and I saw how quickly he was learning at age three, I got really turned on to digital technology, and that pushed me to want to pursue this degree.
Cool. Great. Thank you.
Any other questions for him? We appreciate your time. Appreciate your testimony. I think it's been helpful to our discussion today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, and I think Stephen Kofori would like to provide some testimony as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kofori. I'm here today representing University of Phoenix. We take no position on the bill, but I did want to say that we are presently the largest university in the world. We about half our students attend online classes, and about half of our students are on campus at night school. We have three campuses here in the state of Oregon. I know some of you have had an opportunity to visit them, and if you had, I'd like to invite the rest of you to come. We have about 2,500 students here in the state of Oregon, and degree completion is kind of our bread and butter. We do have advanced degree programs, but the bulk of our students are people who are trained to complete their undergraduate degrees. I don't know that this number is exact now anymore. It's been about a dozen years since I've represented the university, and this number was good at that time, and I assume it's roughly in that ballpark, that there were 750,000 Oregonians who have some college but have not completed a degree. So there's a vast number of folks out there, and all these people have individual needs, and there's a great variety of opportunities for them to fit those individual needs, and for some students, the University of Phoenix is the proper place to go. I asked specifically about our credit for prior learning program. We do have a policy, and we would be very interested in, if this bill passes, in being involved with this commission and this report. We are very much interested in sharing the things that we've learned at the university with other institutions of higher education.
Great, thanks. Did you talk about, let's say, graduation rates or degree attainment of people that are actually pursuing an online or a digital learning within the University of Phoenix?
I don't have numbers that are, I don't know that we break our down okay. that okay. way. And probably do. My experience with the university is they measure everything. And they keep, I can get that information for you. I heard 38%. I believe that our And I can't give a number off the top of my head, but our completion rate is pretty much in the middle level of everybody else's. And like they were saying with the Western Governors University, oftentimes these students are much more have a harder time in school than your average 18-year-old starting out the University of Oregon. And so you find that we found that if you take a skill test at the beginning of the time when our students come to us, and a skill test at when they leave, they start much below the average skill level of a person going to University of Oregon, but they will be at the same level by the time they graduate. We think we do a good job bringing people up. And I want to tell you also, Mr. Chair, we have one other program that you heard this issue about dropping how many students actually complete. We found that a large number of the students who don't complete drop out very early on. And so we have a new program just instituted this year, which is costing us millions of dollars, but we think it's worth doing. And that is we have a one-month free program of orientation where the students get to feel what it's like going online, especially, or going one night a week and having classes that require work during the rest of the week. While you're working full-time is a very, very difficult thing to do. And a lot of people don't realize how hard it is until they get into it. So what we do is put them through a one-month free program, let them get a feeling of, is this something that I can do or not? And at the end of that, if they want to continue, that's great. And if they don't want to continue, that's great, too. And this is improving our ratio of students completing courses.
Very good. Appreciate that, Stephen. Any comments, questions for our witness?
Thank you very much.
Okay, and on the same bill, perhaps talking to a different portion of it, John Wyckoff, did you want to come back? Yay or nay? And Cam Price?
Good afternoon. For the record, Cam Price, Commissioner of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, and we have been working with Co-Chair Dembro on this particular piece of legislation, both the prior learning assessment and the WGU, Western Governors. It was it was last fall that the department and the 17 community college presidents signed a memorandum of understanding with Western Governors because we see it's an advantage for Oregon's community college students to have a seamless transfer. We have been talking with Western Governors University for about the last 6 months prior to that as we went through a process of articulating the degrees that they have for bachelor's with the associate's degrees that we provide. Again, so there was a streamless transfer for students. And part of that agreement is that Oregon students receive a discount on their tuition and their application fee is waived, and we feel like this is a really good option for some students who leave community colleges either with a degree or maybe not, but are able to transfer and benefit from Western Governors and their online programs.
Thanks, Kim.
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff, Legislative Director for the Oregon Community College Association. I just want to make a couple of very brief points. And first, we'd like to thank the Commissioner and CCWD for their good work on this. We think that this creates another good avenue for our students who really need a range of different opportunities to continue their education, and this provides another opportunity with a wide degree of flexibility for students at different points in their life. So we think that's a very good thing. And then the second part here, I'm going to prove Representative Dembro right on what he was telling you earlier, is that our original concern with the way this bill was worded was on the prior learning part, is that it was a configuration that we thought might lead to a tight configuration where the Higher Education Coordinating Commission could set the goal of saying we want more prior learning opportunities, but also would possibly be in charge of implementing that goal. And so what I think the college boards want to see is they're very happy to take a directive that says we want to see more prior learning opportunities, but want to have the loose part of the tight loose to be able to figure out what is the best way to do that, what are the best relationships that they have with institutions in their districts. And so that was what we were looking for, was to get the language to meet the intention, which was to have a tight loose configuration, which we very much appreciate.
Isn't that interesting how we're already paranoid about an institution that doesn't exist yet? So. It's always a boogeyman, right?
It's
the devil. More authority. We don't want to fear of authority.
May I? Certainly. Representative Johnson, on the prior learning assessment, other work that the department has been doing with the 17 colleges has set out over the last year a framework of moving students who have non-credit experience to credit. And in that process, we have actually found four different options of moving from non-credit to credit, and one of them is PLA, a prior learning assessment or a portfolio. But there's also the American Council for Education, otherwise known as ACE, has a set of assessments that one can take, and the returning military veterans often use that. So what we have, and to make John's point, what we've done is an inventory of what the 17 colleges are doing. And so having just one option is more restrictive than you would think, given that we currently have documented four that seem to be working across the 17. So we're happy to have tight and loose. Mm.
One of the parts of this bill that I'm most excited about, though, is that finding ways to give more credit for prior military training and so forth. You know, as we look to having veterans coming back with some multiple deployments, and some of these guys and gals have obviously acquired some very significant skill sets, and the quicker we can give them credit for that is just not only good for them personally, but great for workforce development as well. Have you noticed, I mean, just off the cuff, in the last year, 2 years, I mean, kind of a more of a increase in that segment coming to you looking for that sort of certification and so forth, or do we still have a wave that we would anticipate coming in the next year or so?
Representative Johnson, we have seen an uptick. We are expecting more the full integration and reintegration of returning veterans happens, and particularly a lot of ours are tend to be National Guard.
Yeah.
And they are coming back in higher numbers. And so that's why just last week we actually had for the 17 colleges a training on how to use the ACE, which is the common way that most states use or transcript experience and training from the military into college credit. So we feel like we may not be as robust as we would like to be in that particular arena. We're certainly building professional capacity.
Great. Appreciate that.
If I may just quickly add, Chair Johnson, last session out of a bill that began in the Veterans Committee, Senate Bill 275, addressed this issue, and that training that CCW did was related to that, of trying to make sure that we're connecting students, military training of an incoming student to course credit. And in fact, Clackamas Community College, they've been working with a grant so that they can look at, say, an entire area of a course area and say auto tech, where we're just trying to figure out what the gaps are for the student. And an example of that might be in the military auto tech program, you're not doing environmental quality, because that's not something they don't have to go to DEQ with military vehicles.
And they're happy for that too.
So that would be a gap that they would be looking at, that we try to make sure that students don't have to take, that can fill the gaps and don't have to take anything that's unnecessary.
Great. Appreciate that. Representative Denver.
Thanks. Just following up on that, Mr. Chair, I was at a gathering last year at PCC of students who are veterans, right? And it was a kind of let your hair down and talk about what's not working for you kind of session. And it was a very interesting session for me. You know, students who are coming back from the military are eager, anxious to get going with their lives. And you know, there were a number of people there who were actually very frustrated. They were having to take certain courses that they felt, you know, I already know this stuff, and I'm in a hurry to get on with my life, and I don't know if I have the patience, you know, to keep on this track. And you know, I really believe that it's not true for every student, but there are students out there that where the requirement to take courses in areas that they're already proficient in just leads them to dropping out and not continuing on. And so I do see this, you know, again, as something that can really lead us to more college completion. And for that reason alone, I think it's very positive.
Okay, thank you very much, you guys. Appreciate everybody. Is anybody else here to care to testify to this bill, House Bill 4059? Seeing none. We do have dash one amendments to this bill.
Close the hearing. Is this the
work?
Okay, we'll close the public hearing. We'll open up a work session on House Bill 4059. The effect of the amendments is a little bit on page one. It takes the language referring to the State Board of Education out and inserts community college districts. And on line 15, also adds some language to be adopted by the governing boards of public universities, community college, independent institutions of higher education. So some fairly minor tweaks there, but
the language is tight, but the intent is for more looseness, Mr. Chair.
I think you can take pills for that, but anyway.
Mr. Chair, so I would move that we adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 4059.
All right. Representative Dimbro has moved that we would adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 4059. Any discussion? Any objection? So moved.
Do we have to, can we move this?
Yes.
I think we're okay. I think our fiscal
it does have a subsequent report, though.
It does?
Yes.
And what is the fiscal?
Fiscal is minimal.
The fiscal is minimal. Therefore, we will send it to Ways and Means. So... Mr. Chair, I move. Here's my script. I move adoption. Yeah, I move House Bill 4059 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Mr. Dimbro has moved. We would. Adopt House Bill 4059 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any further discussion on that?
I just like to point out that past speakers have really started this trend in a bad way that don't even continue it even worse now.
That would be a topic to take up with somebody up the food chain for me. But you call the roll, please.
No, I was thinking on past speakers who were with us today.
It's a villainous position, I think. This speaker position, I don't know.
But for the record, since my integrity has been questioned by the the past practice has been that if there's actually a legitimate dollar figure, even $2,000, as Representative Greenlick pointed out with one of his bills, then it's gone to Ways and Means. But if there's not a discernible dollar amount, then it hasn't. So that's the change of practice now.
Well, in this environment we find ourselves in because of the prolonged economic consequences of this recession, I think it's important we look at every aspect of these bills and ensure that they are in line with what we hope they are. So there's a committee there that makes those determinations, so we'll leave it up to them. So would you please call the roll?
Representative Parker?
Excuse.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Lindsey?
Yes.
Representative Sheehan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Greenlick?
Yes.
Co-Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Co-Chair Dembro?
Aye.
Co-Chair Johnson?
Aye. That bill passes. With that, we are finished for today. We'll be back here Thursday. We've got a few more items to move out before we take care of the rest of our business. So with that, our meeting's adjourned.